crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem, a program designed to keep you abreast of significant events in the world of biblical archaeology and also relevant news from the Middle East. On today's program, we'll be surveying back through 2016 to give you our top five archaeological discoveries from here in Israel. We'll also discuss an upcoming article on Watch Jerusalem in which we look forward to 2017 as being the year the world focuses on Jerusalem. Finally, we're going to look at the recent discovery of a 2,000-year-old menorah and also take a look at another couple menorah discoveries over the past few years. Welcome once again to Watch Jerusalem. Welcome to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nachtigall. Before we get to the top five discoveries from biblical archaeology from 2016, I thought I should address the terrorist attack that just took place here in Jerusalem, just on the promenade area, which overlooks the south side of Jerusalem, just under a mile from where I'm recording this. My wife was actually in town when it happened, and thankfully she wasn't close to it, but did see and hear the emergency responders go out to serve the injured people. There were four people killed, soldiers, as a truck ran over these soldiers. It's a popular tourist destination and a place really to overlook Jerusalem, discuss the geography of Jerusalem, and no doubt these soldiers were getting a tour, and a truck by what looks to be an East Jerusalem man driving a truck plowed into them and then got hit on the brakes and then reversed back over them, killing four and injuring 12 that we can see right now. It's still breaking, so we don't really know exactly how many the total will be. But this is just an example of the situation that exists in Jerusalem at the start of 2017. Will we see more attacks like this? Will Jerusalem in 2017 explode with a violent uprising and a violent intifada? In relation to this, I just want to discuss some comments made by outgoing United States Secretary of State John Kerry. He made these yesterday, and they're important to bring up because they highlight what will be one of the most important trends to watch for in 2017, and that is the world's preoccupation on Jerusalem and its need to be divided. Its need to be divided. That is the majority opinion of this world. And some in Israel, the majority of Israelis, don't believe Jerusalem needs to be divided, yet that is what the world believes. And according to the United States, at least the outgoing administration, according to the United Nations Security Council resolution back at the end of December, they believe that as well, that East Jerusalem does not belong to the Israelis, that Israelis, if they are in East Jerusalem right now, are there illegally, that the Israeli government has no jurisdiction over East Jerusalem. Anyway, this is the article. It's from yesterday, as I said, from Jerusalem, the Jerusalem Post. This is how they lead it. The United States Secretary of State John Kerry and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas offered similar warnings to the incoming Trump administration over the weekend, This was their warning. Moving the United States Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem would ignite a violent uprising that no one would be able to control. So the position of Mr. Kerry and the Palestinian Authority leader, they're right down the line together on this. Then the article continues. In an interview with CBS, Kerry, preparing to leave the State Department after engaging in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict intensely over 4 years, said the violent movement would extend beyond the West Bank. Quote, "You'd have an explosion, an absolute explosion in the region. Not just in the West Bank, and perhaps even in Israel itself, but throughout the region," Kerry warned. Now let's just think about this, that the United States, according to Mr. Kerry and Mahmoud Abbas, moving the embassy to Jerusalem, which is the declared capital of Israel by the Israeli government, and it's declared as such by the American government as well. And yet, moving the embassy here to West Jerusalem, I suppose. I doubt they're going to move it to East Jerusalem under a Trump administration. But even just moving it to West Jerusalem, which, under a two-state solution, under a situation where Jerusalem is divided, would obviously stay under Israeli control. And yet, that just one event is going to cause an explosion throughout the region, according to Mr. Kerry. And not just in the West Bank, perhaps not just in Israel itself, but throughout the whole region. Just because the American government is going to move its embassy to West Jerusalem, to Jerusalem. This is continuing a quote now from Mr. Kerry. He said, quote, "The Arab world has enormous interest in the Haram al-Sharif, as it is called, the Temple Mount, the Dome of the Rock, and it is a holy site for the Arab world." Okay. Okay, but what does that have to do with the United States moving their embassy to Israeli territory? Israeli territory that even under a two-state solution would still belong to Israel. Now, I don't know why you would have an explosion of violence. I mean, I could foresee that happening if they do move the embassy there, but why should it? Isn't West Jerusalem considered in anyone's mind the capital of Israel? In the future of a two-state solution, as I said, wouldn't West Jerusalem remain as the capital of the new Israeli state? And yet, Mr. Kerry is revealing that even the Jews being in West Jerusalem is a cause for an explosion. He's right. He's right. We know that the Palestinians don't just desire East Jerusalem, and if they were had received East Jerusalem, they would keep on wanting more. That's why the Palestinian Authority chairman, Mahmoud Abbas, has refused to accept a Jewish state side by side with his Palestinian state. Anyway, I'll continue from this article here. It says, aides to President-elect Donald Trump say he is interested in moving quickly to relocate America's embassy to Jerusalem, Israel's seat of government, and its declared eternal and undivided capital. The Palestinians insist that East Jerusalem or Al-Quds would have to be the capital of a sovereign Palestinian state under any two-state solution to the decades-old conflict. So he, Mr. Trump, is wanting to move fast on this. Fast. He gets into power here the latter part through January this month, another week or so, and he wants to move fast at relocating America's embassy. And if Mr. Kerry is right, we could see a violent explosion across the Middle East because of that. Now, I don't know if the rest of the Middle East is going to get caught up in this. They have many problems. And over the past, you know, few years, 5 or 6 years, the Palestinian-Israeli peace process has fallen out of the minds of most of the Arab world because of their own issues, because of a rising Iran. They've got Iran to contain. So they're not too focused on East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem, the Palestinian conflict with the Israelis. And yet, maybe here in Israel, maybe in the West Bank, and maybe in Jerusalem itself, maybe it would start a violent explosion if they did move the embassy there to Jerusalem. This is what Abbas said, and this was according to an official Palestinian news agency, Wafa. He said this, "We heard a lot of statements relating to moving the U.S. embassy, which we hope are not correct and will not be implemented, but if implemented, then the peace process in the Middle East and even the peace in the world will be in a crisis we will not be able to come out from." Now, it definitely seems a little bit over the top just by moving an embassy to West Jerusalem that we're going to fall into a crisis that we will not come out from. Now, I don't believe necessarily, I think he could stop that. I think the reason that it would, moving the embassy to Jerusalem would inflame violence has everything to do with the incitement that would be whipped up by the Palestinian leadership. But will it threaten the peace of the world? Well, in the long run, it actually will. In the long run, it will threaten the peace of the world. But should it? But should it? Now I want to continue from what Abbas said. He said, quote, we say to those who said it, and this is the United States President-elect Donald Trump, we invite you to visit Palestine, especially Bethlehem next year, and that this statement is not on your agenda because any statement or position that will disrupt or alter the status of Jerusalem is a red line and we will not accept it. So he's putting demands on the next United States president that the status of Jerusalem is a red line. Except I fail to understand why this would be a change of the status of Jerusalem at all. I mean, Jerusalem, this West Jerusalem at least, is Israeli territory, sovereign Israeli territory. Even in a two-state solution, still going to be Israeli territory. And yet, this is going to be used as an excuse, by the Palestinians to start a violent uprising against them. This is what the Jerusalem Post goes on to write. Abbas's statements come just days after senior Fatah officials stated in an interview that the Palestinians would start a, quote, new violent uprising or intifada if the embassy were moved to Jerusalem. And several Jordanian officials have warned of catastrophic consequences should the U.S. proceed with the move, and one calling the action a red line in the bilateral relationship. Well, this all, it just seems a little bit ridiculous to me and shows, though, how far we have come at accepting the Palestinian narrative that Jerusalem being Israel's capital harms peace. Does it really? Does Israel living in Jerusalem, Jews living in Jerusalem as they've done on and off for 3,000 years, does that harm peace with the Palestinians? Well, certainly if you're a Palestinian and you want East Jerusalem as your own capital, as the world now declares is your territory, you would say it does harm peace having Jews there. Now, regardless whether you believe that that Jerusalem should be divided, that it shouldn't be the united capital of the state of Israel or not, these are the facts on the ground. The facts on the ground is that world public opinion, the Palestinians, the United States government that is outgoing, believes it should be divided. Now, this is really important. We've got an article that is coming up in Watch Jerusalem this week, and it is critical to read it because it looks forward at 2017. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War. The Six-Day War when Israel fought against numerous Middle Eastern armies, Arab armies, defended itself, and then ended up, after the war, taking three times the territory that it had before the war started. A miraculous victory, by all accounts. Miraculous. Yet, if you remember that time, or if you've seen footage of that time, what was really the most inspiring part of that Six-Day War? Well, it was when the Israeli army chaplain, he blew the shofar, the rabbi blew a shofar at the Western Wall, announcing to the world that the Jews had captured the Old City. The Jews were returning to the Old City, to the Temple Mount. For the first time in 2,000 years, Jerusalem was united under Jewish rule. And yet that is threatened. This 50-year anniversary is, to some, a time for celebration. But for others, every time they see an Israeli celebrate over this next coming year, they are going to be incensed by it. And this article asked the question, 50 years on, we must ask, will United Jerusalem make it to year 51? Will it? Now, to understand why this year could be extremely pivotal, we need to read that article. We've got to think about just the focus that's coming to Jerusalem right now. We have the Security Council resolution 2 weeks ago unilaterally declaring East Jerusalem Palestinian and that Israel is illegally occupying that land. It wasn't to do with the West Bank specifically. It was about East Jerusalem. Then you've got all this hoopla surrounding the United States moving the embassy there. Then in June, and actually throughout this year here in Jerusalem, we're going to have a lot of celebrations marking the 50-year anniversary of Jerusalem's unity. And as I said, that is going to upset many people. I don't necessarily think it should, but it will. It will. And that is why this year coming up is the year to watch Jerusalem. We're going to be right here to guide you through the significant events that take place, and we're going to help you make sense of it all. Even for people living in Jerusalem, you can know where the events are leading in this city. It's why, really, this program exists. It's why this website exists, watchjerusalem.co.il, so that you can be informed about not only the exciting discoveries in biblical archaeology that happen here in Israel, every single week, it seems. But also so that you can see that these are significant events, even geopolitically, that Jerusalem is at the center of world events. It is at the center of biblical prophecy as well. Please take advantage of the information that we make available to you. So please read this article that's going to come out. It'll probably be there on Monday or Tuesday about Jerusalem 2017. All Eyes on Jerusalem, it's called. We're going to take a short break now. And when we come back, we'll discuss our top five finds from the world of biblical archaeology from 2016. Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I asked one of our staff writers, Christopher Eames, to come up with a list last week of the top five discoveries of the past year in biblical archaeology in anticipation of more discoveries in 2017. I thought it'd be good to look back and see what was discovered here around in Israel from the period of the Bible. And Christopher Eames, of course, is the author of our series on the Bible's buried cities, which has received quite a lot of feedback, positive feedback so far, and I'd encourage you to read up on those. They're each about 2,000 words. We try and deck them out with photos and the occasional video as well to make those cities really live for you, and you can see how the archaeological discoveries are matching the biblical description of the events that took place in those cities. So we have our top five here. Mr. Eames was very grateful for him to put these together. I don't think they're in any particular order. And, well, I hope not, judging by number one, which was the Lachish toilet seat. And I'm just going to read part of what he wrote to me. He said, one of the particularly remarkable finds at Tel Lachish this year would ordinarily be an unlikely contender for great biblical or archaeological significance, a toilet seat. So this was discovered, obviously, earlier this year, right outside or right next door to a massive gatehouse that they discovered there at Lachish as well, or uncovered more of that this past year. Lachish is, of course, a really important city. This was the one of them that was taken over by King Sennacherib of the Assyrian Empire when he came down just before he went to conquer Jerusalem during Hezekiah's time. And that's important because of the discovery of this toilet seat. Now, in this room where the toilet was found, there were also altars, religious altars, cultic altars that had been vandalized. Their horns, which were at the corners, they were smashed off. And this is a deeply symbolic act, as you can see, if you like, from Amos chapter 3 and verse 14, where it actually talks about God visiting the sanctuary or the cultic place at Bethel and smashing the horns of that altar. Well, in the corner of this cultic room, archaeologists discovered a strategically placed toilet seat. There was no evidence, actually, that this toilet seat or this toilet had ever been used. Its presence in this room was merely symbolic, and they could tell that by analyzing the soil around this toilet. And what's interesting is this is a symbol for something else, or the placement of this ancient toilet seat from about 2,700 years ago is symbolic because it does actually have biblical precedent. Now, this time, the precedent doesn't actually come from the southern kingdom of Judah, but it comes from the northern kingdom of Israel. I'd just like to read 2 Kings chapter 10 now in verse 26 to 27. It says this, "And they brought forth the images out of the house of Baal and burned them, and they broke down the image of Baal, and they broke down the house of Baal, and they made it a draft house or a public toilet. Unto this day, thus Jehu destroyed Baal out of Israel." So there was this religious sanctuary, and what they did is they destroyed it, as we can see here in this cultic room in Lachish, and they made it into a public toilet in the north of Israel. And this is something that they did here in the southern kingdom of Judah as well, apparently. Although nobody actually used it as a bathroom, the fact that it was right outside, or right part of basically the whole gate system at the entrance to Lachish wouldn't be the most conducive place to a public toilet. Nevertheless, they thought it was important to show what they thought exactly about this pagan sanctuary. Now, this vandalizing of the pagan room at Lachish is thought to actually have been done by King Hezekiah during the period of revival, of the worship of God under his reign that took place in the very first year of his rule. It really does confirm a tradition then, as recorded in those actions of Jehu, an earlier king of the northern kingdom of Israel, and was meant to show utter contempt toward pagan worship taking place. This is the first bit of evidence that has ever been found that confirms this kind of act as recorded in the Bible. So that was number one, Lachish toilet seat. The second one here that Mr. Eames has is the number two, the oldest mention or Hebrew mention of Jerusalem. Now, you remember when this came out, it was just an amazing time because it came out the same day that the UNESCO resolution that forgot or didn't mention Jerusalem or the Temple Mount in its discussion of Jerusalem and the history of Jerusalem, but it chose to just refer to the Temple Mount as its Arabic name. It also called for the cessation of archaeological excavations in and around the old city as well. Well, you remember that that same day that that resolution passed, there was another discovery that was brought to the public attention. And from researching into this, it seems like it was just a coincidence, surprisingly. Like, you hear about this and you think that the Israeli government planned it, but no, this was planned months in advance to reveal this find at this time. So what did it say? Well, this took place again in a cave within the Judean desert. It yielded a papyrus inscription to have the earliest Hebrew mention of the city Jerusalem. According to some experts, the text dates to about the same time as King Hezekiah, the same time around as that toilet seat 2,700 years ago. And while it's kind of small, only part of it was preserved, only about 2.5 centimeters by 11 centimeters, the text is extremely discernible. It's very easy to read. It refers to a female servant of the king delivering wineskins to Jerusalem. Now, some have questioned the authenticity of this artifact, as it had been recovered from thieves who had reportedly pillaged it from the cave and attempted to sell it to a dealer. So while the papyrus was proven ancient, the authenticity of the actual writing is disputed. But nevertheless, I mean, they wrote it on definitely 2,700 years papyrus. Good luck finding some of that. And it does mention Jerusalem in Hebrew. In Hebrew, because obviously Hebrew was the language of the Israelites, the Jews, a real people who did exist in Jerusalem 2,700 years ago. Number three here on the list from Christopher Eames is the Philistine Cemetery. This was the first ever Philistine cemetery, large one, which has been uncovered within the coastal city of Ashkelon by archaeologists, one of the five major cities of the Philistines during the Philistines lived there, obviously, through the period of the United Monarchy, even before into the period of the Judges, and even after into the period of the divided monarchy between the North and South Kingdom. Obviously, they occupied the coastal region there, had some major cities, Gaza, Gath, Ashkelon was one of them as well. And here, just this past year, they uncovered a massive cemetery. Now, the discovery of this burial ground was a remarkable window into ancient Philistine customs. The gravesite contains over 210 bodies, and they dated between the 11th century BCE to the 8th century BCE, so from the time in and around David and a little bit before him, to the time around Uzziah or Ahaz. And it's really exciting because these bodies obviously were placed there during the time of that really critical part of Israel's history, King David onwards. And just as we have King David's empire, Solomon's empire rising out of the ground in different sites throughout Israel, we also have that same competing civilization, or the competing nation of the Philistines, rising up out of the ground at the same time. And this happened again, this past year, the discovery of this massive Philistine cemetery. It showed by the finds associated with these graves that the Philistines were an advanced society capable of producing really fine quality products. So while there have been plenty of remains of the Philistines that have been uncovered before, Really, strangely enough, there haven't been Philistine burial grounds that have been discovered, but now they have. Now scientists can finally witness the bones of the people themselves. And I think there's going to be a whole lot more discoveries that come out from this, from the study that takes place in the lab after the actual excavation, as to who exactly these people were, what their genes were like, where they came from. All those questions are going to be answered from further study of this cemetery. So that was number three, the Philistine cemetery at Ashkelon. Number four was a part of a burnt Dead Sea scroll. Now, this wasn't a scroll that was found this year. It was discovered back in 1970. But as a result of a truly remarkable scientific process, it was possible, finally, to completely read it this year. So this scroll, it's at least 1,700 years old. Some actually believe it to be earlier than that, around the time of the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, somewhere in that area. This was discovered back in the 1970s in the destruction of a synagogue, which was located on a town at the edge of the Dead Sea at Engedi. And this singed scroll basically was put away in the hope of being able to unravel it without destroying it at some point and being able to read it. Now, if we fast forward to the last couple of years, no, they didn't learn how to unravel it physically without damaging it. They did it virtually. They virtually unwrapped the scroll without unwrapping it really through x-ray scans. Quite ingenious. And they were able to read the scroll. Now, what did it say? Well, it contained portions of both chapters 1 and 2 of the biblical book of Leviticus, the third book of Moses. Michael Sigal, he's a professor of biblical studies at Hebrew University. He worked on the project and he described what was written on the scroll this way. He said, "The text of the two chapters of Leviticus that have been uncovered so far is letter to letter identical to the Masoretic text that we know from medieval manuscripts. Similarly, in these two chapters, the section paragraph divisions are in identical locations as the medieval or the Masoretic text." So what this confirms is that it confirms really the accuracy of the Jews in exactly preserving the scriptures throughout centuries. We had examples of what the scriptures were in 900 AD. And now we can look back at what it looked like 700 years before then or 500 years before then, and it's exactly the same. Nothing changed. Dead Sea Scroll scholar Emmanuel Tov, who participated in the project, he said this, "This is quite amazing for us. In 2,000 years, the text has not changed." It has not changed at all. Now, this was an extremely significant discovery. It's the first program I gave for Watch Jerusalem was about this discovery, and you can go and read more about that. It's called The Hunt for More Dead Sea Scrolls, or not just read, sorry, listen to more about that back from that program. What's exciting about this is that at the same time that they released this find, or I think it was actually the Jerusalem inscription, the Israeli government said that they were going to start an expedition, put resources into finding more of these scrolls of the Bible from 2,000 years ago that shows that it hasn't changed at all from that time. That's what was discovered, at least one proof of that this past year. Now, the final item here on the list compiled by Christopher Reams was the Solomonic Palace at Gezer. We went to Gezer here a few weeks ago to check this out. It's built right alongside the six-chambered gate there, this Solomonic period gatehouse, where similar gates have been built here throughout Israel from the time of Solomon. And you can find that in 1 Kings chapter 9 and verse 15, which talks about King Solomon raising a levy or a group of people, some manpower to go and build certain things. And says there in 1 Kings 9:15 that he was going to build the temple, he was going to build a palace for himself, he was going to build up Milo, he was going to build up the wall of Jerusalem, and also he was going to build up three cities, Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. So at Gezer, we had already known about this gatehouse, but then they excavated quite a lot to the, I forget which direction, maybe it was a westerly direction from this gatehouse. And what they've discovered is a continuation of a massive structure from the time of King Solomon. Now, they dubbed it Solomon's Palace, but the chances are he didn't actually ever live there. But nevertheless, it is dated from this same Solomonic period. Now, why is this important? Well, obviously, it's important because this adds more proof, adds more weight to the truth that the Israelite kingdom during the time of King Solomon was large. It was big enough to have a palace like this, to have gates like this out from the capital city of Jerusalem. Many people claim that he was a legendary figure, King Solomon. They claim, contrary to the biblical account, that Israel was still, to that point, a discombobulated array of nomadic dwellers. But continued excavation at Gezer runs really counter to this theory. Now, if you want to read more up about Gezer, you can do that by going to watchjerusalem.co.il. And I think that city was discussed in depth in an article, The Bible's Buried Cities, Gezer, by Christopher Reams a week or two back. But you can search for that and read more about it there. So that's about it for our top five from 2016 archbiblical archaeological discoveries. We're looking forward to more important discoveries here in the next year. There's a lot of important excavations taking place in Israel through the summer of 2017. Hopefully some more in Jerusalem as well. And many of these excavations will have the opportunity, I'm sure, to uncover some important discoveries to help us understand much more from the biblical period. And they'll also help witness to the accuracy of the biblical account. They will. Now, if you want some more of those details, again, of what we covered today, you can look for Christopher Eames' article on these top five discoveries that'll be going up on the website this coming week. We're going to take one final break here, and when we come back, we're going to discuss a discovery that was made in the past couple of weeks and released to the public last week, which featured the most iconic image in all of Judaism. We'll be right back.
This is Watch Jerusalem on KPCG.fm, where history and prophecy come alive. Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG is produced by the Philadelphia Church of God. The Philadelphia Church of God also supports the Armstrong International Cultural Foundation. The Armstrong International Cultural Foundation sponsors musical activities in Edmond, Oklahoma, as well as archaeological excavations in Jerusalem, Israel. The foundation has participated in excavations with Dr. Eilat Mazar, the Israeli archaeologist who discovered King David's palace, Nehemiah's fortification wall, and seals belonging to princes who persecuted the prophet Jeremiah. More information about the Armstrong International Cultural Foundation can be found at armstrongauditorium.org/about. This is Watch Jerusalem.
This next discovery was actually made a couple of weeks ago by a couple of hikers by accident. They weren't archaeologists, but they were exploring through some subterranean passages in southern Israel, a cave. And as they walked through that cave, which was likely part of a cistern system as well, they noticed carvings on the wall. There was a key, there was a carving of a cross, and there was also a carving of a menorah. Now, this menorah looks like, at least from archaeologists that have since looked at it, they believe it's from the 2nd century AD, and the cross was probably a couple hundred years later from the 4th century AD or CE. Now, the menorah, this is the one that looks exactly like, well, from all the representations we have of the traditional candelabra or lampstand that it stood in the Second Temple in Jerusalem. This one looks similar to that, had seven arms and three legs, just like the menorah as it's described in the Bible, this lampstand that used to sit inside the temple. Now, I'm going to include a short video of this discovery, or at least the Antiquities Authority as they're looking at it, and I'll include a link to that if you want to go and watch that. At least if you're listening to the podcast version of the show, you can find a link to go and look at that. The quality isn't that good, but nevertheless, you get to see up close this engraving, this scratching of a menorah. Now, this is important because there haven't been too many menorahs from 2,000 years ago that have been discovered. This specific cave that is in the Shephelah region, or these lowlands in southern Judea, these caves have long been recognized as probable hideouts for renegade Jews during the time of the Bar Kokhba revolt against the Roman invaders about 2,000 years ago. And this menorah, according at least to Sa'ar Gunner, he's the district archaeologist of Ashkelon for the Israeli Antiquities Authority, he said that the menorah was probably etched in the cistern after the water installation was hewed in the bedrock, maybe by inhabitants of the Jewish settlement that was situated there during the Second Temple period and the time of Bar Kokhba. Then he said the cross was etched later on during the Byzantine period. Now, many modern menorahs, they typically have the nine arms, and you would have seen a lot of that here in Israel through the Hanukkah period, how there is eight represents the eight nights of Hanukkah, these newer menorahs, and one holds the candle that lights the others. This older seven-arm design is actually the one that was used in the first and second temples. Now, there have been other menorahs that have been found archaeologically, or at least engravings of menorahs that have been found in archaeological excavations and on just wall reliefs as well. The most famous one is it exists in Rome in the Arch of Titus. Titus was, again, the son of Vespasian, who was credited of conquering the Jews in 70 AD, of destroying Jerusalem, of ransacking the temple. And in that relief there in Rome, you'll see on Titus's arch is a picture or a pictorial representation of a menorah. The menorah that has been carried by a couple of men as part of the spoils, as the Jews were taken into captivity back then, 2,000 years ago, this menorah was right alongside them. Now, that's probably the most famous one, but the menorah, as I was saying, goes back a whole lot earlier. It's actually described in detail by Moses. That was obviously written over 3,500 years ago, this description in the book of Exodus, that describes how the tabernacle was going to be built up, the tabernacle, the place of religious worship that predated the temple. And inside the tabernacle, there was going to be a specific lampstand, or menorah, as we could call it today. I just want to read from a couple of passages of scripture here so you can see that this is something that is backed up in scripture. It's not tradition. This is something that came directly from the book of Exodus. So Exodus chapter 25 and verse 31 to 32 says this: "You shall also make a lampstand of pure gold. The lampstand shall be of hammered work, its shaft, its branches, its bowls, its ornamental knobs, and flowers shall be of one piece. And six branches shall come out of its sides, three branches on the lampstand out of one side, and three branches of the lampstand out of the other side." So obviously you have here this three branches on one side, three on the other, and one in the very middle. This is the menorah that was constructed to go inside the tabernacle. And then when the temple was constructed, it was to go inside the temple. And no doubt that's what happened. The next mention of this lampstand we have in the Bible is in the book of Zechariah the prophet. And he sees this lampstand in a vision in Zechariah chapter 4. And this is what it says in Zechariah chapter 4 and verse 2 to 3. It says, "And said unto me, What sees you? And I said, I have looked, and behold, a lampstand all of gold, with a bowl upon the top of it, and his seven lamps thereon, and seven pipes to the seven lamps which are on the top thereof, and two olive trees by it, one to the right side of the bowl, and the other to the left side thereof." So you get another couple of interesting points here. You get the seven standard lampstand or menorah, but then it's beside these two olive branches or these two olive trees. Now, Israel, when they wanted to decide what was going to be the national emblem of the state of Israel in 1949, they took this picture in Zechariah of the menorah with two olive branches on either side, and they made it their national emblem. And this is where it came from, this book of Zechariah. Now, what exactly happened to the lampstand that Moses made, or the one that he commissioned to be made? We're not too sure. It probably went into the first temple. But then when the temple was destroyed, we're not exactly sure what happened with it. Or did it go back to Babylon? Probably did, with King Nebuchadnezzar. But by the time that you have the Jews coming back to Jerusalem to rebuild during Cyrus's time, the Persian leader, the first book of Ezra talks about them receiving a lot of the vessels that were used previously in the first temple's service, yet this lampstand isn't mentioned among them. So it's quite possible that that was kept in Babylon. Nevertheless, by the time we get to the second temple period, we do have, starting with Zerubbabel and onwards, we do have a new or another seven lampstand or seven branch lampstand that exists inside the temple. And that was the one that continued in use most likely till the time of through the time of King Herod, all the way through till the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, and then it returned or went to Rome along with the captives, as depicted on the Arch of Titus. And yet, all through Jewish history from that time on, we see the menorah taking its rightful place as a symbol to remind them of their religious worship and where it came from. Now, it's important to remember that the whole tabernacle and temple, the Holy of Holies and the holy place, that was all meant to be a type of God's heavenly temple, his heavenly throne room, a seven-branched menorah or candlestick or lampstand exists in the heavenly temple as well. Now, there have been some other discoveries of depictions of a menorah or engravings of a menorah. The one that we had an opportunity to be a part of was the discovery of the golden menorah at the foot of the Temple Mount back in 2013. Now, this menorah exists stamped on a medallion that's made of gold. And either side of this menorah was a shofar and then also a Torah scroll. And Dr. Mazar believes that this dates from the 6th century CE, so about 600 years after King Herod's time, and in 600 years or 500 years after Jerusalem was originally destroyed, and that first, or that menorah was taken by Titus to Rome. Well, at the time, there was a Persian conquest that came through Jerusalem in 614 AD. And from all these coins that were surrounding where this menorah was found, again, gold coins, it looks like they were minted at the latest possible date of 602 AD. And then they were abandoned after that date. We have a really good video that captures the discovery of the golden menorah and its associated gold hoard quite well, and you can watch that and watch jerusalem.co.il and you'll see it up close. It's extremely shiny. It looks very impressive. But what's interesting about this is that it was discovered buried. I mean, these coins, they were never used for their intended purpose, obviously, and Dr. Messiah assumes that they were buried because the people had to escape. The people that, well, the man that was going to wear this medallion, perhaps a high priest type figure, and this money that was perhaps used to rebuild another temple in the 6th century CE, it never actually was used for that purpose. Dr. Mazar believes that the money and the Torah scroll adornments as well, they may have been used or been brought to Jerusalem by a small group of representatives that wanted to build a synagogue there. Maybe not to rebuild the temple, but at least to build a synagogue. She said, quote, this is from her book, The Discovery of the Menorah Treasure at the Foot of the Temple Mount. She said, it's not inconceivable that it was earmarked as a contribution toward rebuilding the temple itself. This we cannot know, but maybe they were going to do that. Maybe they were going to rebuild the temple in the 6th century CE, but they were not able to do it. I'll continue quoting from her. She says, what is certain is that their mission, whatever it was unsuccessful. The treasure was abandoned and its owners could never return to collect it. They could never return to collect it. And it's actually quite sad. You find it buried in the dirt, right near where the temple was. Unable to use that money to accomplish their purpose. Unable to, you know, wear those garments, including this medallion, in a worship of their god. So what happened? She assumes that the Persians came and they had to get out of Jerusalem and could never build it. Well, what's interesting that in all these cases we have latter-day types of the menorah or depiction of the menorah. There is associated with it and a period of great upset. I mean, if we're going to talk about the Arch of Titus that has a menorah, that was because They had just gone into captivity because of their rebellion against God in 70 AD. And then if we're going to talk about this other menorah that was found at or right below the Temple Mount just a couple of years ago, they were never able to actually fulfill their purpose because they were ran out of town again. Now, if you actually, what's interesting, if you at the excavation site on the Ophel there, if you go directly under where this was found, through the earth, through the bedrock, you'll get into a cave or a cistern that was used or filled up during the time of the 70 AD destruction of Jerusalem, and Jews perhaps probably lived there, trying to hide, trying to survive the siege that was going on above them. And then even if you look at this recent discovery of a menorah etched onto another cistern wall or cave wall in the southern region of Judea, why were they there in the cave? Well, they were hiding again during the time of the Bar Kokhba revolt. Every time we see a menorah used or coming up, it's accompanied by a period of sadness. And that was not the point of the menorah. Ever. The menorah was meant to give light. It was meant to be burning continuously. And yet what we see is it's accompanied all these discoveries by heartache, by Jews going into captivity in times of war, of Jews not being able to fulfill what they wanted to do because of the attacks of outside nations. And here we are again, thousands of years later, 2,000 years later, at least from the discovery of this, of the latest inscription or engraving of a menorah on a cave wall that come out. And yes, we can be excited about it because it does show how relevant that history is anciently to today. But at the same time, it should be a stark warning. Why were they in a cave engraving this Jewish insignia on a wall? Why is there no temple today that would have a menorah in it? Really, it gets back to those items that were on the golden menorah found at the foot of the Temple Mount. The two items on it, not just a menorah, you had a shofar which is blown as an alarm of war to warn what is coming. And that is what Watch Jerusalem is all about. To show what is coming, not just to bring doom and gloom, but to show how to escape it. That's the point of a shofar, not blowing it, war's coming, there's nothing you can do. There's everything that you can do if you answer the call of the shofar, and it has everything to do with the second thing that was on that golden menorah, a Torah scroll. Getting back to keeping the law. And that's very difficult. But God says in a very hopeful message, even in the book of Ezekiel, which was written just as Jerusalem was falling originally, the first time, just as that menorah was being taken again, he said that Israel will be able to return and that Israel finally will be able to keep the law as well. This is what Ezekiel wrote in chapter 11 and verse 17. He said this, "Therefore say, thus says the eternal God, I will gather you from the people and assemble you out of the countries where you have been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel." Now, this hasn't happened yet. This isn't taking place today. This isn't about the 1948 God bringing Jews back. This is about Israel, all of the tribes of Israel, not just the tribes of Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. This is about all of Israel. It hasn't happened yet. And then it continues, verse 18, "And they shall come there and shall take away all the detestable things thereof and the abominations thereof from there. And I will give them one heart, and I will put a new spirit within you, and I will take away the stony heart of their flesh, and I will give them a heart of flesh." Why? "So that they will be able to walk in my statutes and keep my ordinances and do them, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God." Now there's the hope that is coming to Israel. There's the hope that is coming to Jerusalem. At times like this, when we see the world ganging up on the Jews again, in a similar way, at a precursor to the way that they've done it time and time and time again, we need to recognize that there is hope and it has everything to do with this menorah. It has everything to do with responding to the shofar, and it has everything to do with keeping that law. That brings us to about the end of another show here of Watch Jerusalem. If you would like to send us some feedback, you can do that by emailing letters at watchjerusalem.co.il, or you can write to us at P.O. Box 8314, Jerusalem, Israel, 910-8201. Don't forget to stop by Watch Jerusalem This Week, the website, for the latest analysis pieces involving both archaeology and biblical prophecy. You can also sign up to receive our new weekly update. That's an email that's sent out every Friday to ensure that you don't miss anything from the website. I'm Brent Nachtigall, and you've been listening to Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive.